Good evening and welcome to tonight's lecture, Street Medicine, Just What the Doctor Ordered, presented by the 4th Street Clinic, the Street Medicine Institute, and KCPW Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of KCPW. We're pleased to broadcast this event live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, and you can stream it live on our website as well, kcpw.org. Street medicine, of course, is an emerging field, a movement to reorient patients at the center of healthcare delivery. In addition to working in traditional emergency rooms and clinics, street medicine doctors practice on the streets, under viaducts, and along riverbanks, giving care directly to the homeless and to society's most vulnerable citizens. Tonight, we'll hear from two foremost experts in the field of street medicine, Dr. Jim Withers and Dr. Pat Perry. Both have been instrumental mentors to the street medicine program now offered by the 4th Street Clinic here in Salt Lake City. Before I introduce them, a note about format for tonight's discussion. Dr. Withers and Dr. Perry will each take about 30 minutes to talk about their groundbreaking work in this field. And after their remarks, those present in the audience at the City Library will have an opportunity to join our discussion. We'll have roving microphones, so get those questions ready. Now on to our guests to introduce Dr. Jim Withers. He is the medical director and the founder of Operation Safety Net, the first full-time comprehensive medical service for the homeless. He's also the founder and medical director of the Street Medicine Institute, which helps communities establish street medicine programs. He's also an internist at Mercy Hospital in Pittsburgh. Dr. Pat Perry is chairman of the board of directors for the Street Medicine Institute, and he's also the medical director and founder of the program for the homeless and urban poverty medicine at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. Please join me in welcoming to Salt Lake City Drs. Jim Withers and Pat Perry.
Well, thank you very much. It's delightful to be here and to celebrate the work that you're doing, and also to look forward to the symposium that will be hosted here in the end of September. So thank you very much for having both Dr. Perry and I here. Tonight we're going to be discussing street medicine from the point of view of how I think it helps us look at healthcare in a more general way. It's ironic, but very profound, I think, that you can go to the margins of society and look back at how folks are being treated, how healthcare is being delivered, and I think it reveals some of the difficulties and challenges that we don't appreciate when we're within our own structure. So that's the journey that we've all experienced, those who do work with the underserved, and specifically in street medicine. So we're going to talk about that and some of the lessons that we've learned, and then, of course, a chance for us to talk together. So the question is, what is street medicine? Well, street medicine is the delivery of medical care, and we use medical care in the broadest sense, which includes a commitment to the health of the people that you're working with. But it's the bringing of that health care, that medical care, directly to those who are not part of the housed homeless population, the people who are living on the streets. And they have different terms in different parts of the world. The unsheltered homeless in Great Britain, they're the rough sleepers, and the pavement dwellers in India. But most communities have a subpopulation of the homeless who do not sleep in the shelters and don't engage systems. So street medicine serves to go to where the people are rather than asking them to come to us. Why do we need street medicine? Well, for exactly the reasons that I stated, is that there are folks who, for whatever reason, are alienated and disenfranchised from systems that are well-intentioned many times, but really are ones that most of the chronically homeless street patients don't see as user-friendly, or they don't have the insurance, or they don't have the self-esteem, really, to want to get the care that's available for them. And then finally, we're going to deal with the question of how can street medicine help change mainstream healthcare for the better? And those are arguments that Dr. Perry and I will bring out further in the talk. So as I said, the delivery of medical care directly to those sleeping on the streets involves any variety of ways of doing this. The simplest method is just to go out and walk into the alleys, along the riverbanks, and even into the abandoned buildings of our communities. The programs generally have approach of the walking teams, and they also incorporate medical vans, but you know, in whatever it takes to get to where the folks are, that's really the modus operandi of street medicine. It should be noted that street medicine is not adequate health care. It's just the beginning, an entry point, if you will, inviting people to a journey that leads to better health care. So by its nature, every street medicine program advocates with the homeless and for the homeless to get them into higher levels of care. So street medicine is an active vehicle to bring people into the rest of the resources that society has for them. These are some images here of us working on the streets. This is a young man that I met early in my street medicine career, and it looks like I'm just taking his blood pressure, but I can tell you, when I started going out on the streets, it was unusual to have anybody from the medical profession in that setting. So I was being watched by all the other folks in the camps and in the various parts of the street community. And I think the symbolism of working with the folks in the street really sent shockwaves, rumors, if you will, between camps, one bridge to the next. And there was a great deal of excitement that healthcare was going to come out to where the people were. A lot of what we do has to do with engaging people and building trust. It's easy to say, but it's not always easy to do. And it takes a great deal of patience to be working with people exactly where they're at. This photograph that we have in front of us, you can see a lot of things in this picture. I'm shaking the hand of a man who's chronically on the street, and he knows me, he trusts me. To the right, there's a mental health worker that has been invited to come on the streets. He doesn't know this person, and at this point I'm just reconnecting with my friend on the streets. And I like the lady on the left of the picture. She's kind of looking at us like, what are you up to? And here I'm trying to graft some of the trust in the handshake between the mental health worker and the homeless man. You can see there's a lot of eye contact. They're checking each other out. But to a great degree, I think the long-term trust that I was able to develop with this gentleman then allows the next person to begin a relationship that can lead to something better. Our environment is very fluid. We carry our medicines in backpacks, and we usually cover different sections of the city. Different teams will do that work. And as this picture shows, there's a lot of things going on in this campsite that's under a bridge in Pittsburgh. There's students taking notes. There's the outreach worker engaging someone else, and I'm focusing on the patient in front of us here. It's a great environment to take students. We use this as a classroom for students to understand how it is to be on someone else's turf, to listen to their stories and to build relationship with people that are different than they are. So we have residents and others that come out, and many have gone on to careers in service-oriented medicine. So in addition to the direct care that we render, I think it's a long-term investment in the future nurses and pharmacists and doctors and all the different social workers and others that come out and work with us. I can tell you that it's exciting work. We always have a waiting line of students that want to come on the street with us and work. And so I think in some ways we've really revitalized medical education through the work that we're doing. It's most programs have both the walking component and then medical vans, and I think that's this is our large motor vehicle here, and so some folks want to come and sit, and other folks you have to go find. And the bottom line is that wherever people are, we will go there and meet them on their terms. So I'd like to turn things over to Dr. Perry now that you have a sense of what street medicine does. He'd like to talk a little bit about why it makes sense.
I'm going to set up for you the chronic street homeless as a case study of a challenging, non-user-friendly population that really stresses our healthcare system in unique ways that we can learn from. The three things that contribute most profoundly to the problems that we see on the street are poverty, lack of access to care, and social disenfranchisement. And those result rather quickly in most cases in compounded illness, including medical health, mental health, substance abuse and addiction problems, disability, suffering, and premature death. It's helpful to understand that homelessness is a fluid model, and that if there's going to be a response that is meaningful and interventions designed or catered to the individuals, it has to be receptive to working across the spectrum of homelessness, from those who are unsheltered, sleeping on the streets, in traditional homeless shelters, doubled up with friends or family, transiently housed in hospitals, drug and alcohol treatment programs, and permanently housed in housing sites around our urban cities, primarily through the housing first models that are sweeping the nation. To try to get our hands around how many people are experiencing homelessness in a given city or in our country, it really depends on who's asking. And the political and economic undertones of that question have profound impacts on where the money goes and how it's distributed. The two primary methods are point-in-time counts or period prevalence counts. The period prevalence counts are more accurate because they tell us how many people might be experiencing homelessness over the course of a given period, like a year. And the point-in-time counts, which are routinely done in our major cities, tell us how many people are actually homeless on a given night. 650,000 people are estimated to be homeless on a given night in the country in 2010, and 3.5 million people experiencing homelessness at some point during that same year. Most of the chronic homeless population are adults, most are male, and interestingly, most have a disabling condition. Not many of those disabling conditions have been effectively documented or have led to applications for entitled benefits like SSI or SSDI. Many of the adult males who are out on the streets have served in our armed forces. They're veterans. The fastest growing segment of the homeless population, however, are families, primarily women with children. Many are actively employed, and about half, or more than half in some states, have no health insurance whatsoever. You may be wondering, how does the Affordable Care Act that we've been hearing so much about lately in the news, how will that impact the homeless population? We'll touch on that later. In Utah, to bring this problem local, in 2011, on their point-in-time count, which happened one night at the end of January, over 3,000 homeless people were counted in the state. Approximately 80% of those live here in Salt Lake City. And over the course of the year, it's estimated that 14,000 people experience homelessness at some point. The two main causes of homelessness have stayed the same for as long as this country has been in existence. Number one, lack of affordable housing. In 2012, there was no place, I'll say that again, no place in the United States where a full-time worker earning minimum wage could afford a one-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent standard, which indicates no more than 33% of one's income be spent on housing. Obviously, there are lots of folks who are housed, but it's forcing difficult decisions with the rest of their income. And one of those difficult decisions comes around healthcare. In Salt Lake City, this means that a full-time worker would have to earn over $11 an hour, or the equivalent of 1.5 minimum wage jobs, to afford a one-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent standard. In addition to lack of affordable housing, poverty is the second major contributor. The current federal 100% of the current federal poverty level is about $11,000 for an individual, $22,000 for a family, meaning that 15% of the current U.S. population falls below that poverty line. Other causes of homelessness include mental illness, substance abuse, addiction, physical disability, and catastrophic events like domestic violence, foreclosure or eviction, and fire and disaster. To appreciate where the resources are going and why the population is so costly to the system, it's helpful to appreciate the difference between transient homelessness and chronic homelessness. Most people experience homelessness for a short period of time. They only utilize a third of the system's resources, but a minority remain homeless for more than 6 months out of a given year and utilize over half of the resources. So it makes sense that targeting this chronic population would have the highest yield. A seminal study was published in 1997 by a homeless healthcare researcher named Steve Wong in Boston, who worked with the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program, one of the oldest programs in the country. I was fortunate to work with that program on their street outreach team for 10 years and am intimately familiar with this data. Of 18,000 people that program encountered during that five-year period, almost 600 deaths were recorded. And among those 600 deaths, the mean age of death, the average age of death, a shocking 47 years old. That is almost three decades younger than average life expectancy for the general population during that time period. Other studies in major cities have confirmed these findings. So what are the risk factors for death? Maybe if we could understand what it was that was predisposing people to dying so early, we could design an effective intervention. So from that same time period, among those people who died, we looked at the factors other than homelessness that were associated with the risk of dying. Each of those cases was compared to someone who was alive at the end of the follow-up period. And it was noted that that death typically occurred within 2 years of the first contact. That's an enormous amount of pressure on healthcare providers and other service providers who intend to make meaningful change, because it really compresses the time frame or the therapeutic window in which that can happen. You might expect that the most commonly associated risk factors for dying would be substance abuse, addiction, or mental illness. And this study found quite the opposite. The factors that were most strongly associated with your risk of dying were chronic medical problems. These are some of the same problems that the general population dies from, but these folks are dying 20 to 30 years earlier and at much higher rates. In one way, this is encouraging because it tells us that if we could design a better care model, a better primary care model, we might be able to impact some of these preventable and treatable conditions. So using those high-risk criteria, the Boston group identified 119 of their chronically street homeless folks who met one or more of those risk factors for dying and put them into a group and then tracked that group over the next 10 years. You can see the risk factors that would land you in that group if you're elderly over the age of 60, if you have a combination of serious medical illness, mental health illness, substance abuse, or addiction, if you've been a frequent visitor to local emergency rooms or been hospitalized, if you have HIV or AIDS, kidney disease, liver disease, or a history of exposure-related injuries like frostbite or hypothermia. And after following that group for 5 years, and I use the five-year number because it's relatable, we talk about a lot of medical diseases with five-year mortality rates, meaning with that disease, a certain percentage of folks would die after 5 years. For this cohort, it's a very surprising outcome. To demonstrate to you the complexity of that illness, I show you these graphs, which show that the majority of people have chronic medical illness and chronic mental illness and substance abuse or addiction. Massachusetts is an interesting state because most people have health insurance access there. A while back, healthcare was mandated, and Medicaid eligibility is extremely liberal. 5 years later, in that cohort that was so sick and had access to care, still one-third of that cohort was dead at 5 years. So if we reframe chronic street homelessness as a medical problem instead of a social problem, we realize that it's a disease that strikes people in their early 40s, kills a third of them within 5 years. It's really profoundly impactful. The Centers for Disease Control believes that if this population were larger in our country, that it would be declared an epidemic. This is an interesting picture. When I first began my training in Boston in 2001, this picture was taken, and these folks who are depicted here, 11 of them, 10 men, one woman, are seated in a little park that's less than 500 feet from the entrance to Mass General Hospital. I just saw the other day that Mass General Hospital was rated as the number one hospital in the world by US News and World Report. And these folks are living chronically on the street in its shadow. 10 years later, I found this picture again when I was prepared to leave Boston, and I was very sad to discover that only one of those 11 were still alive 10 years later. The causes of death in this group are spread out pretty evenly throughout the year, and we see from this graph that most of the causes of death are those chronic medical problems that I was referring to that are treatable and manageable in the right model. Here's the real zinger. That for that high-risk cohort, those people who were so sick and dying at such a rapid rate, they were incredibly expensive to the system as well. So whatever the system was doing is highly inefficient in the care for those folks. In that five-year period, those 119 individuals racked up 18,000 emergency room visits to the largest three urban hospitals in Boston, an average of over 30 visits per person per year, and 800 hospitalizations. If you break down the cost, that's $22,000 per person per year simply in emergency room visits. Shocking number. To put that in perspective, the cost of the average annual one-bedroom rent in Boston during that same time period, $10,000 a year. So it's not hard to fathom that maybe if a meaningful intervention like housing were coordinated with primary care health services, that we could make a substantial investment that would save money over the long run. In fact, that's what's happening in Boston. Other cities, including Salt Lake City, which has had a very successful housing and wraparound healthcare model. It's the same story when you talk about homeless people are being admitted to the hospital. They stay in the hospital almost twice as long as their peers and cost exceedingly more, over $2,500 more per admission, with a total excess cost of $8 million over a five-year period. You can imagine that some of the barriers to meeting safe discharge plans for those folks could be overcome by a healthcare system or a delivery model that was accessible not only on the streets, not only in the shelters, not only in the hospital-based clinics, but inside the hospital itself to better coordinate their care, reduce the length of stay, reduce the chance that they would end up back in the hospital. There are three important ways that illness impacts homelessness. It can be part of the cause of homelessness. It can be part of the maintenance of homelessness, and it can be part of the complication of homelessness. These are the folks that are the most difficult. These are the ones that have become stuck in homelessness in large part because they've become ill. The implications, in summary, that the hospitalization rate are five times higher than the general population. They die at 3.5 times the rate, and more than 40% of these folks become disabled, but only a small percentage actually have put in successful applications for disability benefits. So what are we doing wrong as a healthcare system in serving this population? I don't mean to focus too much on the street homeless, but to use this as an example of one sick, high-utilizing population that mainstream healthcare is doing an utterly poor job at not only treating, but also doing so in an efficient way. This photo illustrates quite a few of those missteps. I can tell you that this gentleman, in by way of the green bag hanging on the back of that wheelchair, was just discharged from the emergency department and is sleeping about 100 feet from the door of the emergency department. You can see on his left leg he has a knee immobilizer brace, which is incredibly difficult to walk with. He's down on the ground right outside an exhaust vent for heat that's blowing the exhaust from that building right onto his face. This gentleman is at extremely high risk for dying tonight, that night, because of the state that he's been discharged from the hospital in. What better way might there be to create a safe discharge plan for this fellow that would reduce his risk of dying, not increase it? So the challenges that we face in designing these interventions tell us that there are chronic conditions that are hard to treat without housing. Imagine how difficult it is to manage one's diabetes without a fixed place, without a bed, without a refrigerator, at risk of your diabetic equipment and supplies being stolen, an erratic eating cycle, dependent on eating from soup kitchens and shelters that don't serve a diabetic healthy diet. Problems are presenting in advanced stages because of the lack of preventative and management care. Patient priorities are rightly on food, shelter, clothing, and safety, not on conditions that they can't feel and don't imminently threaten their ability to achieve the former, especially high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney disease, or liver disease. There are daily challenges of good nutrition, personal hygiene, and basic first aid, and they suffer from fragmented and ineffective care. So let me show you one idea for a model that does make a difference, and it's a model that's nimble and flexible. It moves easily with the same team of interdisciplinary providers moving between different settings that those folks may access, the streets, the shelters, the clinics, the hospitals, a medical respite program if a city is lucky enough to have it, and permanent housing. And all of that is tied together with a common electronic medical record that tracks these visits and maintains continuity. Some of the features of this kind of primary care model, as you look at this list, you'll recognize that these are things that I think you would want in your own healthcare. You would want your own primary care delivery model to be sensitive, to be patient-centered, comprehensive, multidisciplinary, cost-effective, accessible, comfortable, and respectful. So does the Affordable Care Act offer us any help? If Medicaid expansion is accepted by this state and others in January of 2014, all individuals with an income level up to 133% of the federal poverty level, that means about $14,000 of annual income per year, they will qualify for Medicaid coverage. Currently, only women and children are automatically included in that coverage. Individuals with an income up to 400% of the federal poverty level will be eligible to buy low-cost insurance products as well. This is certainly a step in the right direction because it will at least give access. But if the proper care models aren't in place that help to prevent and manage those chronic conditions that are a scourge to the population, I don't think we'll see any tangible benefit. In fact, there's a risk that utilization might go up because more folks would be encouraged to inappropriately visit the ER or be hospitalized now that there's not a risk of incurring a huge hospital bill. Take for a moment to think about the impact and the ways that poor health and homelessness are related. We call this the morbidity cycle, and you can see how one feeds the other. With poor health, you develop disability, worsen poverty, and continue to receive fragmented and ineffective care. As that precipitates or worsens homelessness, there is a contribution of trauma, both physical and psychological, shame and despair, which further worsens health. People who are caught in this cycle begin to spin faster and faster, and the interventions are less and less easy. As an example, I present to you the case of Jim, a gentleman that I knew from the streets in Boston. Jim is 54 years old, chronically homeless, living on the streets and out of the shelters for about 15 years. He had alcohol and heroin dependence, major depression and anxiety, repeated heart valve replacements because of his drug use, requiring blood thinners, but he could not take those blood thinners because he had been fired by hospital clinics because of so-called non-compliance. He had suffered multiple strokes and heart attacks, had hepatitis C infection with complications, a seizure disorder from multiple head injuries, and prostate cancer. This is an incredibly challenging and complex individual. He is prototypical of folks who are chronically homeless on the street, whether they start that way or end up that way. And to drive home the point about high utilization of the healthcare system, Jim had 25 emergency room visits, including 8 hospitalizations in a 1-year period in 2005, racking up 108 hospital days. So 1 out of every 3 days was spent in the hospital. An emergency room visit during that time period cost about $700, 1 hospital day about $1,000. So you can quickly do the math and realize that in 1 year, this patient racked up over $100,000 in healthcare costs at one of the major urban hospitals in Boston. So what happened here? We showed you that 108 hospital days in 1 year, but I didn't tell you the full story. The first 4 months of the year, Jim was out on the streets, and the majority of those ER visits and hospitalizations happened in that time. 94 of the total 108 hospital visits happened in the first 4 months. In the next 8 months, Jim was in a combination of housing and medical respite care. His utilization of healthcare dropped dramatically, 14 hospital days, and the same team of physicians, mental health workers, case managers, and social workers that helped Jim out on the streets and got to know him and engaged him were able to follow him into housing and into respite to help reduce the chance that he got sick and died, and the utilization became dramatically less, on the order of tenfold less money spent in the second half of the year compared to the first. And here's Jim here on the right. He was an avid Red Sox fan, and he was housed when the Red Sox won the World Series, much to his thrill. I'll turn this back over to Jim to talk to you about some of the core values that street medicine espouses and how those values translate across the healthcare system, not only applicable to the folks we serve on the streets, but to all of us in meaningful change in the way that care is delivered to make it more cost-effective and more efficient.
Thank you. So in the process of doing this work, Pat and I and others, you know, we've been reflecting on what are the core values, the core qualities of the care that has emerged that seems to make it work, and these are some of those ideas that have come up, and I'd just like to discuss. Let me just say that we feel that these are values that should be applied to all healthcare. These are the principles that you can learn on the street, but then these lessons need to be taken into the general methods of delivering care. Probably the first thing that strikes us is that you have to deal with reality. If you don't deal with reality, things are just not going to work out as well. So, for instance, if you have a street person coming into your system and you don't take into account the complexity of the factors that Pat was describing, it's going to be like a slippery bar of soap. You're just not going to get a handle on the issue. And the only way to do that is to go directly where people are. This is the case of a gentleman that we were seeing in the photo here, where we're bandaging his foot. And this guy didn't have a lot of responsibility for his health at this point, I can say. He was the victim of frostbite, so all the toes that he had been removed. But the problem was, in addition, there were infections of the bones of his feet. So he was being admitted to our Pittsburgh hospital system frequently. And each time the bone was infected, they would have to admit him for 6 weeks of intravenous antibiotic therapy. We estimate that each admission was probably around $42,000. They would treat him, and then they would street him. And when he was back on the streets, what was there would not fully heal over. So we're targeting the care to this gentleman, and we were able to get his feet to heal up. We saved hundreds of thousands of dollars in just this one instance by working with him, dealing with the reality of his situation, his feelings about his own health and level of responsibility at that time, and it was a very satisfying. And he was not readmitted for bone infections beyond that point. This is a more graphic photo, I'm sorry. But there are many of the older homeless, street homeless in our country that suffer diseases and conditions such as the leg of this 85-year-old street person due to his own characteristics. He had untreated and difficult to treat paranoid schizophrenia. So he was wandering the streets, trying to avoid entities he felt were pursuing him. And as a result, his legs were swelling. He could never lay down and rest because he was being chased in his own mind. And so the skin would break down, and these large ulcers would appear. And as you can see, at this point, it's gotten to the point where he actually has maggots in the wounds of his feet there. And this is a guy who the court system had seen and decided each time that he was competent to take care of himself, and so he would go back to the streets. He was refusing any kind of medical care. So what do you do with a situation like this? Well, what we did was we just developed a relationship. And by working over the course of several years with him, we were able to develop the kind of rapport and sense of trust that he was able to accept housing that we had offered to him. And this is a picture of him and me and my three boys when they were smaller. In a nursing retirement kind of a home for him, but it was only by working, believe me, by working on his terms, that we were able to achieve this. So one of the pleasures of street medicine is the ability to really focus and get to know the individual and work with them as they are, rather than trying to put, as Pat said, the proverbial round peg in a square hole. Another core concept is that with our work with the folks on the street, we set aside judgment as much as possible. Ultimately, I think there's a mutuality in that, because a lot of the street folks, I think, have come to judge the non-homeless. They assume that people don't care about them, that there's really no one there that will stick with them through the ups and downs and the complexities of their health care and social journeys. So all the folks that work with us, I think we share a sense that each human being is precious and worthy of respect. And it's only by that approach, I think, that people will begin to see the value that they have themselves, and therefore embrace the changes that we've seen. And honestly, from the early 90s when I saw this work, I've seen things that I would not have believed possible in terms of people changing their lives and embracing healing. You got to be creative, I can tell you that as well, on the streets, and you got to be very flexible with people. This is a friend of mine, George, who was, as you can see from the expression on his face here, he's nobody's fool, and he's not about to accept anyone else's rules. And that was really a fundamental characteristic of him and a lot of the folks that we work with on the streets. One night, we were out visiting him, and he came out and asked for some cough syrup. And I looked at his arm, and it was bent at a very unnatural angle, and he had broken his forearm pretty badly. And I said, "Well, okay, here's a cough syrup, but what about your arm?" And he says, "I'd rather die than go to the hospital. I'm not about to do that." And I realized that this problem was just going to get worse, and he probably was going to either lose the arm or maybe his life if something wasn't done. So I'd gotten to know and George very well, and he trusted me. So we get to play with our situations here. So the next morning I showed up, and in those days I had a nice little shiny red convertible. So I pulled up in my red convertible and said, "Hey, George, you want to take a ride? And I'll stick with you through this. I'll make sure that you're always with me or someone else that that you trust while you're in the hospital. And reluctantly, he agreed. And then through the support of other team members who were particularly one trauma surgeon that was part of our team, we were able to bring him to the hospital, get his arm fixed, and get him back on the street. And it healed up just fine. But that's the sort of creativity that we enjoy actually exhibiting, because it acknowledges the individuals. Well, this photo may not make sense. It's a picture of one of my formerly homeless partners here, Mike, and a volunteer. And we've got a piles of garbage that we've collected. Well, this is a fellow that we saw that was living in a literally in garbage in one of the abandoned warehouses of Pittsburgh. When we first met him, Richie, he was surprised that anyone would come and visit him, because he'd given up on himself. He was a Korean War veteran, very depressed, and he basically was just drinking himself to death. And he had a cough, and I wanted to have an x-ray of him, but there was no way he was going to leave the garbage that he was living in. And we worked with him, and we tried to gain his trust, and he enjoyed our visits, but he wasn't budging. So one night, it was raining, and we decided again to be flexible and think, how would it be to be Richie? And I was convinced that Richie saw himself literally as the garbage that he was sleeping in. So I said, you know what, let's not just walk all over the city tonight. Let's focus on Richie, and let's see if we can clean his place up. And if by cleaning his place up, maybe he'll look at himself differently. So it turned out to be actually a really funny night. We went down there. We borrowed some garbage bags from the hospital, and we came to his place. And all he had to do was hold a flashlight for us, and he was quite amazed. And we actually gathered up 20 garbage bags full of material that was really filthy. And someone had donated some carpet to me, so I thought, oh, that's what that's for. So we took that down, and we laid it out and gave him a clean place. And then a couple days later, the nurse came and gave him a haircut and a tetanus shot. And the next time we visited him, he had a bottle, but this time it had flowers in it. And he showed us pictures of his family. We worked with Richie, and after a few weeks, he said, you know what, I want to get out of here. And he accepted housing in a place for some of the older homeless guys. And I would visit him, and I went to have dinner with him one evening. And I said, hey, where are the pictures of your family? And he said, oh, my gosh, I left them down in the camp. So we got in our car, and this is, in the day, and we drove down. And he looked around, and he found the pictures of his family. And as we were walking out of the garbage that was still there, Richie just stopped. And he looked around, and he said, how could a human being live in a place like this? And for me, that made it all worthwhile, because I had been told by people who were peers and other people in the community that I was wasting my time, that these people out there, they choose to live like that. That's how they want to live. And if I had taken the snapshot of Richie when I first met him, yeah, that's a likely conclusion. But by seeing more in Richie, maybe than he saw for himself, and then allowing him through our consistent approach, respectful approach to him, and a little creativity, he was able to see himself differently. I think this transcends all of healthcare. Every time we work with someone in healthcare, they're looking to us to see that someone believes in them and that they can embrace the changes that they need to make. It's just a lot of fun doing this on the street, I can tell you that. And again, it's all about the person. This is Lois. We affectionately call her J-Lo. She's a tough woman right here in the middle of our picture. And when we found her, she was living in a snowbank. We were afraid that she was gonna freeze to death. And it was by working with her over time, we tried to get her in a shelter, and she couldn't deal with it. So she would go back out, and despite her small size and shape, she's very hardy. And eventually, she began sleeping next to our building. And I thought, oh, we're getting somewhere now. But she developed a deep bond with the nurse here and the medical student. And this happy picture is a result of a lot of work with her as a person and belief in herself. We took her to her birthday for dinner for her birthday while she was still on the street, and she just loved that. It was like an elegant event for her. And here she is. She's coming to her first primary care appointment. And then finally, I think it's about social justice. This is a picture of a refrigerator box, but there's a person inside of this refrigerator box. They used to call him Caveman in Pittsburgh. He was very troubled emotionally, and he lived in this box. And pretty much the only way you knew he was alive is that he would throw a rock at you or something. But we were not about to give up on him. And unfortunately, he got caught in the cold. And this is his foot. In fact, both feet were frozen, and the tops of his feet were taken off. The hospital did a great job fixing his feet. They did surgery that was able to restore at least the back halves of his feet, and he was able to walk with some difficulty. But unfortunately, he returned right back to the street. This is a night of crisis for us when we were afraid that he was going to freeze to death. And so we brought a psychiatrist out. This psychiatrist was very compassionate and helped us get him taken to a psychiatric hospital. But at that psychiatric hospital, we made the mistake of not staying there to make sure things would work well. So they looked at him and they said, "Do you want to kill yourself?" "No." "Do you want to kill someone else?" "No." And they said, "Okay, you can go home." So he was sent back out in the snowstorm with hardly any clothes, back to this setting. And really, it's a matter of miscommunication, but it's also a matter of following through and making sure people get the care they want. Ironically, we got him into that psychiatric hospital. He got well. He was housed. He inherited some money, and he gave it to that hospital. So it worked out well for them in the end. But this is the kind of stuff we see all the time. We see, like, this gentleman here, still in his hospital gown, people being discharged to the streets. And we're witnesses to what isn't working on the other side of the fence. And it's very natural for us then to become advocates. We try to be as respectful of the healthcare and the police and the other parts of community and look at them as an opportunity to collaborate. But we have a special window on the street folks because we're out there all the time, and therefore we can help both the homeless and the systems that try to serve them. And finally, I think that at the deepest level, street medicine is one way of improving a sense of community. We certainly have this happen in Pittsburgh, and I've seen it wherever street medicine has come. This is my friend Bill, and when I took Bill's picture, Bill said, "Don't take my picture." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, I've been to your office, and I've seen the people on your wall, and they're all dead. You know, you take pictures of people, and they die." And I said, "Well, just let me take a picture." And he said, "Okay." And unfortunately, he died the next week. And some of this was the scientific approach that Pat was saying. There were a lot of those risk factors. But a lot of it was the fact that I was just feeling that Bill was giving up. He just was going to give up. His dad had died as an alcoholic around that age. It was his time. And it began to really bother me a great deal. People were dying on the streets, and as I would go through the streets, I would grieve them, but also I felt that they were watching me, really. There was where little Eva was kicked to death, and this is where Frank had died, and we never knew what happened to Billy, but he died there on the street. And so I got angry, and I decided that I would buy plaques. So what I did was I bought memorial plaques that said, "We remember," and the name of the person and the year. And my plan was that I would put them in the sidewalk wherever a person was murdered or had died, and that they would accumulate throughout the city of Pittsburgh, and that this would cause a stir and people would begin to talk. Well, the police pointed out that that wasn't legal. So we then went to the mayor's office again, a good collaborative move, and we developed a wall where we could put the plaques of the people that died. And every year, we have a memorial service on December 21st to remember them. And each person that dies, what was good and what we remembered about them is discussed, and they're honored. And I, probably more than anything else in this ceremony, I feel like we're building community. We recognize that everybody matters, that we're all really brothers and sisters in the end, and that unless we're in it together, we're never really going to be able to solve the issues that we all have. So these are some of the lessons and values, I think, that come out of the work of getting out on the streets. I'm going to let Pat talk a little bit about the Institute and some upcoming things.
So you've heard and seen some of the experiences that Jim and I have had on the street, and I can assure you that these programs, these activities, are happening all over this country and all over the world. In recognition of that, we felt it was very important that we find a way to connect those programs to one another, to learn from one another. One of those programs is here in Salt Lake City with Fourth Street Clinic, Volunteers of America, working closely together to provide street medical care to this city's homeless population. And it is through the efforts of the Street Medicine Institute and one of its chief operations having an international street medicine symposium that those programs were connected with us and that we came to know what good work is happening here. The Street Medicine Institute provides expert training, guidance, and support to help communities and clinicians develop and grow their own street medicine programs. Currently, we have a network of 85 programs in 15 countries on 5 continents. We also provide service learning opportunities for students. As Jim alluded to, the street work is a powerful classroom where students of all varieties can learn lessons and a model of care that they don't get in traditional medical education. And it can prepare them not only for careers in service, but also sensitize them to challenging populations or marginal populations that they're sure to encounter, whatever field or specialty they go into. We advocate for meaningful change in healthcare systems as well, using some of the information that you've heard tonight to reflect back to our hospitals and clinics to help them improve the care not only of homeless people, but all those who are disenfranchised or too complicated to succeed. We host an International Street Medicine Symposium. This year is the 8th annual International Street Medicine Symposium, and we've chosen specifically to host it here in Salt Lake City because of the wonderful programming that's happening that the rest of the country and world can learn from. It's happening September 27th to 29th with a special Street Medicine 101 for folks who are new to the field happening on the 26th. All are invited. You do not have to be a healthcare professional to attend. Community stakeholders, service agency staff, and even consumers, that is those who have been homeless before, are welcome. It's being held at the Health Sciences Education Building on the medical campus of the University of Utah. There is no registration fee, but we do ask that you register in advance on our website at streetmedicine.org for more information and quick online registration. We really thank you for coming tonight and thank the listening audience for their attention.
Dr. Perry, Dr. Withers, thank you for this eye-opening introduction to street medicine. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a live lecture here on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM. The lecture is Street Medicine, Just What the Doctor Ordered, sponsored by the 4th Street Clinic, the Street Medicine Institute, and KCPW. As our doctors get settled into the panel, we will now invite members of our listening audience, our live audience here at the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, to jump in with some questions. If you would clearly state your name, the city where you live, and your brief question, we'll get through as many questions as possible. We've got a couple of roving microphones. So, questions from the audience. Let's go straight to the top, right over here.
Yes, I live in Salt Lake City, and you know, we see the change I've been doing in this type of medicine, but I would like to ask the doctor, both of them, anybody can answer, is what are they doing in order to prevent the people from getting sick? I mean, you know, do they have a diet, a health, you know, healthy diet? Can they improve that way so they don't have to get sick all the time? What are they doing in that part, you know, preventing that happen, not after, you know, it's already happened? Thank you.
Certainly.
Dr. Withers.
Certainly. Yeah, it's a very important question, and it certainly is one that all the healthcare professionals that work with street folks worry about and think about, because it's so much better to prevent problems than to have to try to fix them afterwards. But it's a real challenge in the street environment. It depends on the individuals, but in Pittsburgh, for example, we have screening. We have a van. We've developed a collaboration with the county and the Healthcare for the Homeless and some other groups to do X-rays to see if anyone has tuberculosis. We check for hepatitis and if vaccinate if appropriate, and HIV as well. The influenza vaccines are given as possible, but it can be a kind of an elusive a group to work with in that regard as well. I think so much of it depends on setting the relationship, particularly, let's say, with women who need a pap smear or need a mammogram. It helps to get to know that individual. You have to get sometimes to know the people around her. If she has a boyfriend, if she's in an abusive situation, if she's prostituting. I mean, these are all complicated things when it comes to bringing someone to that first visit. But when we see the risk there, we focus on that individual and we create with them a pathway that will allow that to happen. And we make special arrangements for that person then to be able to do it in a flexible way that fits their motivation and their schedule or whatever it is that they're juggling. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Pat.
I think the only thing I would add is to say that even for those who are motivated to maintain a healthy lifestyle while experiencing homelessness, that situation is characterized by the loss of control and the loss of choice. So the kind of choices that we would make in our own lives with the resources that we have to lead healthy lifestyles, whether that be through diet, exercise, preventative health care, those things are either not accessible to folks experiencing homelessness, or what is accessible is very much outside of their control. For instance, if one is dependent on eating at a shelter or a soup kitchen, take a visit to your local shelter or soup kitchen and see what's being served. It's food that's easily reheated, most of it processed, high in carbohydrates and fat, very difficult to maintain a healthy diet based on the choices that are presented in those venues.
Hmm. Next question. Is there one on the side? Yes, right in the back.
Laura Jones, Salt Lake City. Dr. Withers, you talked a couple of times about other folks in the medical community said you're wasting your time. So tell us about the challenges or the successes in engaging the broader medical community as these programs are picked up in different cities across the country.
Right. We do spend a lot of time on the phone and internet with folks that have decided to get into this field, and they realize that, gosh, not everyone's happy that I'm doing this. And there's some common themes and lessons that have emerged. The process of going out into the streets, we call outreach, and that's pretty straightforward. You go out and you get to know who's out there. I think an interesting part of that journey that people realize is there comes a point where you have to figure out who you are when you're in the street. What is a street nurse? What's a street doctor? What's a street social worker? And eventually what happens is you become a part of that community. You become the street person, the street medical person or whatever, and you're trusted and you understand the ebb and flow of things. Well, right around that time, things flip around and you start looking with them into the system. And that journey into healthcare, we're calling inReach. And it's walking in solidarity with people into those things that make sense for them and that they've negotiated that that's what they really want.
And by honoring that, it puts wind in the sails, and then they get the momentum. But you encounter a lot of misunderstanding. And what Paul Farmer calls, structural violence. There's just things that don't work for this person because of who they are. But for one little thing, maybe it would work. So we approach the emergency rooms and the social workers and the police and any part of that world that's important, and we present ourselves to them. And we say, we've got this service. We're out there. In fact, we're pretty much out there all the time. And we have a toll-free 24/7 number. So if you see someone in your emergency room that's being discharged and they've got some frostbite and you're worried about them, you can call this number at 2 in the morning and you'll get an answer. And we will follow up on how that person's doing. So we come to the systems asking them how we can serve them. They're the other half of our business. How can we make this work for you? And usually when you listen to their point of view and listen to their what they're proud of and what they're frustrated with, you make friends and you get people that will work with you. And that changes the culture. But sometimes it just takes an example. Like the first time Grandpa came to the ER of my hospital, they didn't want to let him in because he was covered with lice. And we just said, it's okay. All we want to do is use the shower. You don't even have to get close to us. So we took him in, and our outreach nurse took his clothes up to the washer and dryer and cleaned them, and because he wouldn't take new clothes. And I stood there next to him in the shower, this 85-year-old guy, while he sang Italian songs and got cleaned up. And when we were done and we got him dressed up and taken care of and the lice taken care of, and we're walking him out of the door, you could just see the folks in the ER, their whole attitude had changed. And they began calling us. And the same thing happened with the police. I went to them. And after we presented our work, we began getting calls from the police force. So in a way, there's a sort of a, it has legs. You get into the rest of society by following where the homeless need to go. And you can speak with them. And really, as much as my homeless partner was my ambassador to the street, I realize that I can be the ambassador into the healthcare system and others because I have street cred there, you know, like he has credibility on the streets. In the end, I think we're just people, and I think people like to finally get to that point where they can just look at each other and say, I could be there. That's okay. That's a long answer to your question, but it's a fascinating experience to walk in from the outside of your own hospital.
Dr. Perry, did you have anything to add before our next question?
No, I thought that was very profound. Thanks, Jen.
Terrific. Jen, is there someone on this side? Oh, right over here. White shirt.
Peggy Redessel, Salt Lake City. How do you keep yourselves from being homeless, i.e., how do you get paid?
And the first part of that I want to address is this idea of professional homelessness, that within our own medical communities, many folks who choose to do this work or feel it's important to do as part of their profession or their career alienate themselves from their own communities. There are a lot of folks in healthcare who have significant resistance to the patient population because of repeated bad experiences, and they transfer that resistance, those ill feelings, to you. And you hear things like, why are you wasting your time? These folks won't get any better. We don't want you encouraging them coming here. They just make things worse for everybody. They're too frustrating. We could better use these resources somewhere else. So there's that piece of sort of feeling homeless as a provider and not being accepted by your own healthcare community, trying to practice the things that you thought were the fundamental moral core, relieving suffering where it existed and, you know, reducing illness and disability. The second part of that is the literal homelessness. That is, how does anyone sustain themselves financially in this kind of work? It's a tricky question, and it depends on one's local environment, their socio-cultural value system in the community that they work in, the support of local and state government agencies. Often these programs are run on a charitable basis through private donations or sponsorships from churches or community organizations as well. It's unusual to find systemic support from the kind of institutions and political avenues that we would hope would be actively engaged and involved. That's more the exception than the rule. So I have to say that the answer to that question is it really depends where you live and practice, how you can sustain yourself in this work.
Hmm. We have a lot of experience, though, within the street medicine movement. And so if you choose this path, you're family with us. And we've got lots of folks that have managed to navigate that with some very interesting strategies. A lot of times there's teaching professions involved, or someone will have a career where they can juggle things. We've got one formerly homeless doctor in Santa Barbara that works at night with the street people and with day with movie stars. And she said that, you know, they're not that different in many ways. and therefore she's able to sort of walk with kings and commoners, I guess, is what Rudyard Kipling said. But we're committed to this field and each other, and we're working towards ways to bring the monetary value to the field as well through advocacy.
Other questions? Yes. Here and then in the middle.
Hi there. I'm wondering how homelessness in the U.S. compares to other countries in the world.
I think that what we learn from our colleagues in developed and undeveloped countries who do this work is in stark contrast to what we see in the States. We are lucky in the sense that we have an existing healthcare structure that can be very effective for a significant percentage of the population, but not for all. So our sort of challenge is to say, how do we improve the access or tweak the delivery models? In India, in Calcutta, where Dr. Jack Prager works with the Calcutta Rescue Mission, one of our street medicine practitioners, the situation is starkly different. There are literally millions of people sleeping out on the pavement, and it's hard to know where to begin. The existing healthcare structure serves a very small minority well. So most of the care that's delivered is the only care that's delivered. There's not an idea about improving, you know, access or opening a door that used to be closed to a good health mainstream healthcare system. That doesn't exist. So what they do looks more like disaster medicine or austerity medicine in a lot of ways, and that experience is much different than what we deal with in the States.
I had my travels in Scandinavia, I have some envy of the systems there that at least guarantee the healthcare is available. And in a sense, they can work more purely with the behavioral issues, you know, the stuff that we love as healers to get involved with. And fewer of the mechanical barriers, but it's actually the human element is remarkably similar no matter where you go, and there are street folks throughout the world that see themselves and society sees them in the same way. I think that we've kind of marginalized our people here.
Sir,
George Durham, Salt Lake City. One of your slides indicated that 40% of homeless are veterans. So this is a question about systems communication. Do you feel there's progress either with the Pentagon or with the Veterans Administration system in sensitization to these issues for either prevention or not transferring someone out of a VA hospital back to a snowbank, et cetera?
In some cities, the VAs have been leaders in services to chronically homeless veterans. In particular, I'll point out at this year's symposium in September, there'll be a fantastic presentation from folks at the VA hospital in Los Angeles County who have developed an exemplary program that provides integrated medical, mental health, substance abuse, and case management to chronically homeless veterans who have recently been housed and helping them maintain their housing by treating all of those health problems in an integrated way. One of the great advantages of the VA system is that they have one of the more comprehensive and accessible electronic medical records shared across the country. That's a huge value to an effort that aims to treat people who are by nature transient and discontinuous in the ways that they access care, visiting multiple different hospitals that traditionally don't share information, different clinic sites, access points that change over time, moving between cities or communities. It's extraordinarily helpful if someone's care has been based in the VA that when that person pops up in Salt Lake City, there's the opportunity to know what happened in LA when that person was staying there and to coordinate those services better. So there's great potential within the VA system. In many cities, they have really seized that potential and done a wonderful job of caring for those vets. Mm.
Other questions? Yes, right here. And then in the front.
Libby Hunter, Salt Lake City. What challenges and opportunities do you see with the Affordable Care Act?
I'm sorry?
What challenges and opportunities do you see with the Affordable Care Act?
Dr. Withers?
I rely on Pat for my information. Okay,
Dr. Perry.
I think the Affordable Care Act is a good step. I'll, you know, by fair divulgence, Jim and I are both proponents of a single-payer system of universal health care access, as are most who are in homeless health care, because we see that as the most equitable way to distribute existing resources to those who are most disenfranchised. The Affordable Care Act does offer some promise because, as you saw in the talk, most of our homeless population are individuals. They're adult individuals, which right now are outside of Medicaid eligibility in most states. So that, if the Affordable Care Act is accepted, and keep in mind, it needs to be adopted by each state. A state has the ability to refuse Medicaid expansion, and so far, 24 governors have lined up to say, we're not gonna do it. That's a challenge in and of itself. But if, presuming that the Affordable Care Act came through, there's a secondary challenge there because healthcare access, the insurance card in the pocket, doesn't guarantee good healthcare in any way. In fact, the other kinds of reform that need to happen along with health insurance reform include payment reform and primary care reform. If everybody, you know, the case example is if everybody suddenly has an insurance card but doesn't have a primary care doctor who's taking new patients, there's going to be no change in the patterns of utilization. In fact, utilization might go up because they might feel more free to get their care in an inappropriate place like an emergency department and not be accessing the preventable care or the management of chronic diseases that someone with a primary care doctor might have the opportunity to. So there's potential there. It certainly can be a big shot in the arm to homeless healthcare programs because it opens the door for reimbursement. Many of the patients that are served by street medicine programs around the country, they eat some of the costs of serving those without health insurance. So if more people are eligible for Medicaid, it will be easier for those programs to sustain themselves by caring for them because they'll get reimbursed for the services provided.
Sir, here.
Simpson, Salt Lake City. The work that you do is intuitively and morally, obviously, the right thing to do. Our healthcare system, for better or worse, is enamored with outcomes. You referred to a gentleman who had dramatic cost savings by being placed in a respite facility. On a more incremental level, what kinds of things do you look at in terms of outcomes that help you justify to third-party payers and governmental agencies, et cetera, the work that you do?
Yeah, the data is lacking to a large degree with street medicine, largely because the folks that do it don't have usually the institutional infrastructure to do much. But we can count some things. One of the ways that we look at and there's a lot of inference, because to get a whole city to cooperate in their data on between different ERs is like getting kingdoms to work together, and it takes years. There's a good champion of that in Camden, New Jersey, Jeff Brenner, who's actually looked at the cost, the highest utilizers by getting three of their hospital systems to actually cooperate on this issue, and has identified that of the extremely high utilizers using most of the cost, a good percentage of those are the street homeless. So there's a lot of inferential things like that that we look at. But the number of people who are insured, we've targeted efforts to get them their insurance. The number of people that achieve primary care relationships, those are important. Again, some of those things in terms of preventive parameters such as screening tests and immunizations are things that we can look at. You can pick almost anything and get started on it. Dental exams, and it's difficult though to easily link mortality and morbidity in the current state of most street medicine programs. It's nice when you've got a community that maybe has one big hospital where they could, in theory, politically do this, but most of us don't have that kind of situation. We've seen a decrease in frostbite, the loss of toes and fingers, in the last 7 years, and we'd like to take credit for that. But again, the data isn't really firm. I don't know if you have, Pat, any other...
I think one of the easiest things that folks can do in their own communities with their own hospitals is to run claims data on some individuals that you may have encountered that you think, oh, I bet this person has really racked up a lot of healthcare cost. And that claims data can be requested from the hospital in the same way that medical records can be requested. The patient signs a release form, and you get the data about what services have been rendered in a given time period, how much those services cost, whether they were reimbursed or not reimbursed. And there's a quick way of identifying a small group of people who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of cost. And then you take that to the hospital administration, and then you say, look, we have a different idea about how we might engage this person, and care for them. It's going to happen in a different model than what you're used to. Are you willing to invest in that in the hopes that we can provide some cost savings? Because this is money that's already on the table. It's money that you've already lost or has been spent out of the system. One of our favorite things to do is to trumpet the amount of charitable care that a hospital system provides. They all have to provide a community benefit report at the end of the year to the state attorney general, and in that is included the amount of uncompensated care that they delivered. And oftentimes that's trumpeted in brochures as something good that the hospital has done, and we turn that around and say you should be ashamed of this, because this is money that's used to stamp out fires. It's emergency room visits and hospitalizations. Most of that uncompensated care is not directed toward prevention or chronic disease management. And if you had only invested a smaller portion of that money in the models that we know work, like street medicine models and others adapted to unique populations, the chances that you would incur those losses would be much less.
I think one of the personal, and I think it's a collective experience, of improving health, the most dramatic thing that happens is when you can get someone housed. We've housed over 800 chronic homeless people in the last 8 years in our Pittsburgh system, with about 75% to 80% retaining that housing. And I spend about 25% of my time now just doing house calls to people that actually have houses now that I used to know under the bridges. And I see an acceleration of improvement in those healthcare parameters. When you're on the street and you're slugging, you're up to your neck in alligators, so to speak, it is very difficult. I feel that profound things are happening under the surface. People are beginning to consider changes in their lives, and they're it's a pre-contemplative period, but there's a lot that goes on in that part of their life. A lot of folks look at people in the street and say they haven't hit bottom. You have to wait for them to hit bottom. But I'm convinced that by weaving into the fabric of the existing street community, people that care, people that are non-judgmental, people that don't promise more than they can deliver, but that has a big effect on how people eventually then make decisions that are much more healthy. I think it really matters. I think it matters to have physicians out there because of the symbolic value, as well as the ability to intervene when something really serious is happening. You can get someone into the hospital where a social worker may have a great deal of trouble. So it's a team effort. Measuring things on the street is an exciting thing that I'm hoping that we're going to get partnerships with schools of public health and such, but we're just on the cusp of really being able to ask for those things.
While we're on the subject of money, Dr. Perry, you mentioned in your presentation that ER visits are about $22,000 a year. Wondering if you've calculated the cost of street medicine visits versus ER visits.
That's a great question. I'll give you two levels of answer to that. So in a model of care, and I'll use Boston as an example, where the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program provides services that are largely reimbursed by Medicaid, that this work that we do out on the streets is sort of submitted and billed to Medicaid. And those are relatively simple encounters that would then go into the system, something similar to an urgent care visit in a primary care clinic in the turnaround. And the cost of a visit like that is usually somewhere between, you know, $75 and $125. The reimbursement for a visit from Medicaid is somewhere between $50 and $100 for that. That same problem, say, immersion foot, which happens when skin doesn't have a chance to dry and begins to break down, becomes very painful and can increase the risk of infection. That same problem in the emergency room costs $1,000, and the treatment is really dependent on follow-up care. There's no one thing you can do in that moment in the emergency room to fix it. The prescription for treatment is applying creams, keeping the feet dry. Those are things that are done in follow-up care. So when you add up the number of visits required to perform that follow-up care, or better yet, if that care is provided in a medical respite setting, that is a supervised clinical setting for folks who are too sick for the streets or the shelters but not sick enough for the hospital, the cost is at least half, and usually more like 20% of the equivalent expenditure for an emergency room encounter for the same problem.
You're listening to a live lecture, Street Medicine, Just What the Doctor Ordered, presented by the 4th Street Clinic, the Street Medicine Institute, and KCPW Public Radio. On our panel, Dr. Jim Withers, Medical Director and founder of Operation Safety Net and of the Street Medicine Institute, and Dr. Pat Perry, the Chairman of the Board of the Directors for the Street Medicine Institute and Medical Director and founder of the Program for Homelessness and Urban Poverty Medicine at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. We're before a live audience here at the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, taking questions from our audience members. Other questions from our audience? No further questions. Well, then, I would love to thank you for your participation in this discussion. Also, a big thank you to Dr. Perry and to Dr. Withers for their insight on this eye-opening topic. The conversation is a precursor to the International Street Medicine Symposium, which will be held here in Salt Lake City, September 27th through the 29th. And again, there's more information on their website, streammedicine.org. We'll have a link at kcpw.org. www.fourthstreetclinic.org. This special broadcast sponsored by the 4th Street Clinic, the Street Medicine Institute, and KCPW Salt Lake City. Thanks to KCPW's Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Also Jennifer Hyvenen at the 4th Street Clinic. And I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good night. Thanks so much for coming.